That's a very good tradition.
The House Committee on Education will come to order. So please join us at the dais. Welcome to the Friday afternoon House Committee on Education. For the record, we are going to carry over House Bill 2062 and House Bill 2063 until Monday, February 16th. And if we are ready to move on them at that time, we will. I anticipate it would be at least Wednesday before that happens. Also, at this time, if you have a cell phone with you, would you please turn it off, all the way off, not on vibrate, but all the way off, so that you can be completely focused on what we're doing here today. Today we are doing public hearings on House Bill 2380 and 2419. We're going to have an informational meeting on career education technology, which is scheduled first. But I see Representative Greenlick in the back of the room, so I'm going to invite him up first to present testimony on his bill, and then we'll move over into the informational hearing. If that's okay. So I am going to open and if you're here to testify on House Bill 2419, I'm temporarily opening it to take testimony from Representative Greenlick. Then we're going to close it, go to career technology, and then come back to the food and beverage standards. So I open a public hearing on House Bill 2419. Representative Greenlick.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, which is Northwest Portland, the North Plains, in historic Tualatin County. I was very active in developing the bill that 2419 is amending in the last session. We worked very hard to create better nutrition in the schools. And the bill that we crafted after, I guess, maybe two sessions, made that move in a way that made a lot of sense. And it created a model that limited the extent to which a variety of non-nutritious options would be eliminated from the schools, both in the primary schools and eventually in the secondary schools. In that bill, we never, as I remember, had any discussion at all about the extent to which these standards would be applied to adult members of the school community. We talked a lot about creating the proper culture in the schools, creating the proper models in the schools for kids to learn what their proper options are. And we actually talked about the whole question of norms in society, how we were going to eventually change children's behavior and eventually adults' behavior by crafting new ways to address unhealthy snacks in our culture, which, as you know, they abound. But I believe the intention of the bill was to change what was offered to children in the school system. After we passed it, it came to my attention, and you have a bill in front of you that you'll hear more testimony on, that it automatically applied to vending machines and food opportunities in the teachers' lounges. And my first reaction was, no, that can't be right. That's nothing that we intended. And we didn't have any testimony on adult behavior, although we will this session. We'll have restaurant menu labeling and lots of time to talk about adults in society. But I was surprised to find an unintended consequence of the bill we had passed was it affected choices in the teachers' lounges. Now, I hope teachers make wise choices. I hope I make wiser choices. In fact, I'm starting back on Weight Watchers in the morning to help for the several times being a life member of Weight Watchers and being so far away from my goal, it's going to be a long time to get there again, which I have been before. But it seems to me we didn't debate that and we didn't intend it, and I think I would urge you to seriously consider House Bill 2419 and put the system back where it was, I think we intended it to be.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions for Representative Greenlick? Representative Thatcher.
Oh. Yeah, thank you. I remember this bill. And I was looking through a file of testimony, and there was a whole list of people that supported it, like parent-teacher conference, or not the conferences, parent-teacher association, Stand for Children, Children First, all that. And one of the testimonies that was given, well, a lot of them actually talk about reinforcing example modeling, and I think they would be talking about the adults, but schools need to become good role models. The staff in schools teach students self-motivated lifelong nutrition habits. Children's behaviors are so substantially affected by influential adults in their lives, including teachers. And one testimony I really thought was appropriate was, what restrictions and guidelines are you willing to live with yourself? It's not just about kids, it's about you too. You can't expect the kids to stay away from chocolates when you have a chocolate bar in your hand as you're talking to them. And that was from a vending company too. But anyway, it was from Roblin Rep Vending Company. I just wonder if we now say exempt teachers who are supposed to be the models, if maybe we should be looking at making something more livable for everybody rather than just having two different standards.
Madam Chair and Rep. Thatcher, I absolutely agree with everything you just said. And my assumption would be that that teachers will certainly in public behave in that way, but there is a sanctity in the teacher's lounge, as I know talking to my teacher friends and relatives, that provides a little respite for the teachers from their day-to-day life. I mean, I remember my wife trying to escape into the bathroom when she had a 4, 3, and a 1-year-old kid, and the kids being outside the door screaming, "Mommy, Mommy, where are you?" And
I think this. There's...
you know that. I expect you all do. But it seems to me having the ability to buy a Diet Coke in the teacher's lounge is probably not going to change their ability to be role models, and I would recommend that their options are essentially the same as kids' options in terms of my recommendation to them. But I think in terms of dealing with adult choices, it's a somewhat different matter. But I absolutely hope teachers in all public ways will not be holding a chocolate bar in their hand while they're talking to kids or drinking a Diet Coke while they're talking to kids.
Yeah. Are there further questions for Representative Rebel?
No, I'm faking. I barely have this opportunity.
Would you be willing to consider this as an amendment to House Bill 2009?
No. But maybe I could find another relating
call. Representative Comp.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Greenlick, thank you for bringing this forward. I certainly have no problem with what this bill is stating, but I do not see anything, and I'm reading it quickly, that the purchase of food and the eating of it needs to, and I hate to be this nitpicky, needs to stay in the employee rooms, because there is nothing more frustrating than having students come up to you as a school administrator and say, "Well, Mrs. Anyway, so-and-so is doing such and such," and it's the kids tattling on the adults. And I don't want to get that nitpicky, but it seems, and never mind.
I think it's great for kids to tattle on the adults.
No, it is not. You're the principal.
Representative Roebling.
In the question, in our previous bill, it did not say that a parent couldn't send anything they want with their to school with their child. So
right.
the issue is not whether there's different things being eaten at the school. It's that the school does not put in front of people for their options to buy those kinds of foods for kids. And so, I mean, I think that's going to continue to be an option. We continue to have conversations with people. But I think I appreciate your sanctity issue. People do in their faculty rooms have pop or other kinds of things. Many of them don't have it, but I don't think we need to start telling people where and what they can eat as adults. I mean, I think we hopefully we can do, and we don't tell the kids what they can or can't do. The parents make those decisions. It's just what is provided at the school. And I think those are the ways you start changing behaviors over time. So I appreciate both bills. I thank you, and I was certain that it didn't prescribe what parents put in lunches for their kids. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Are there any further questions for Representative Greenlee?
I don't know if it's a question for him, but I was just wondering. I remember the teacher's lounge popping in there, getting a peek in there, and you could see the clouds of smoke. And did we ban smoking?
Yes, we did.
Oh. Yeah, a long time ago. Yes.
We didn't say they couldn't smoke. They just can't smoke in the buildings. But we did that in a lot of different buildings.
I think it started with teachers.
It started with teachers.
No, I agree. It was sort of exotic to look in there and see.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I'm thinking the teachers in my district might be amazed to hear their teacher's lounge described as exotic. Are there any further questions? No? Great. Thank you, Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And so for those of you that walked in late, we were temporarily opening this public hearing. We will come back to this item in about a half hour. So I am... Am I closing it, or am I temporarily closing it?
You can leave it open if you want. You can leave it open.
I will leave it open, but we are now moving also to...
And you need to open that one.
We are now opening an informational hearing on career technology in schools, and I would invite Donna Keim from the Corvallis School District to come forward. Donna, I've known Donna for a long time. Donna and I actually had the opportunity to serve together on the Corvallis School Board for quite some time, and since we were both there, we have both moved on to other things. I am here, and she is now working in career education at Corvallis High School. And several months ago, last fall, Donna and one of her colleagues came to talk to me about some software that's been developed and used in the Corvallis community, not only to track the career-related requirements, but also to engage students in opportunities for internships and externships and community involvement, and to encourage businesses to become involved in mentoring and other kinds of relationships with young people in the districts. And they had asked at that time if they might be able to come and share a little bit of this information with us in hopes that other districts might be able to benefit from the work that's gone into this without having to reinvent the wheel. So, and the way that this works, if you just introduce yourself for the record and
do I need to do the address too? Is that
your name and where you're from.
Donna Keim from Corvallis, Oregon at Corvallis High School. And thank you, Representative Gelzer. I was going to bring that up, that we had worked together on the school board. Being the true teacher that's in me, I've got paperwork for you, but I'm going to give it to you after the presentation, so I know I have your attention. And I've got, my goal is to take about 15 minutes just to kind of give you a little history lesson of what we've been doing in Corvallis, and then to have the last 10 minutes to be question and answer, so more for the dialogue, but just to give you the information. And then I'll have the information I'll keep with you. So, when we first started talking to Representative Gelzer, we were talking about, you know, there's a real need to look at career-related requirements, and it needs to be a government and a Department of Education issue. And that's why it was really important that we wanted to come talk to you, and that's why I'm here. So who am I? Why is this so important to me? I have been involved in Corvallis High School for the last 19 years. I grew up in L.A. I was a teacher there briefly before my husband and I moved to Corvallis, Oregon to go to graduate school. 4 kids later, we never left. Our kids have gone through the system. My older 2 kids are wanting to be teachers, and my younger two are twins in high school. So I've been everywhere from the room parent, the jogathon carnival coordinator, PTA president at a very difficult time in the early 90s when we had to close three schools and had to be the person to help make sure that transition worked for those kids at that school, school board member. And then I became on staff. And the reason I got on staff is while I was on the school board, we started talking about the career-related requirements and what did that mean for students. And I got very excited about it. I helped with the levy that helped that was passed to help take care of four positions in our district. And they were all career learning. It's a learning team to say, how can we make sure those career requirements happen? So got so excited as I was lobbying for the levy. My older daughter was old enough now to take my part in our role of our business for 23 years. We're both in education. And I said, you know, it's time for me to not only talk about this, I want to get in there and help. So got the job as one of the career counselors and have loved it. Been there for this is my second year. So in that 19 years of being involved with the school district, I can tell you that our district has been 10 years working on saying, as part of our district improvement plan, how can we make sure kids are getting more experience looking at career options and then it's meshing in with their other subjects and that they truly have at least a path that they're following as they leave the high schools. First, we went the route with our ESD program. 7 years, we were building a thing called eFolio. It was a virtual portfolio to help keep track of their occupation, patient interests, the reflections, and then be able to let that go with them and get onto their transcripts to show that, yes, they're meeting their career requirements. Worked for 7 years. It never worked. The reason being, A, you're starting from scratch. You have a very limited money or task of anyone who's even working with it. And B, to make it really work, it needed to be more widespread than just our district paying for it so that it would pay for itself. Money was always an issue on how do you track career-related requirements, both the person and the software program to make it work. It's always been an issue. We finally formally killed it as of spring of last year. I think some of it was because we now had four people in place that were really spending a lot of time looking at it, figuring out how does it work, what do we need, and we came up with another recommendation. So we decided the CIS program is Career Information Systems. And the reason we picked this was it's been around for 35 years. It's updated every year with the cooperation of the Department of Employment so that everything that has to do with wages and information is always being updated. We're not having to take care of that ourselves at our district level. It also gives you, if you notice over here, it gives you a portfolio. See where it says, Welcome, Donna. Mm-hmm. I have now have a portfolio that stays with me for life so that no matter what career changes I make, I can keep all my information in there, be it resumes, jobs that I've had, training programs I want to get into, how can I transfer all of my credits. It does everything for me so that as I move on to a different job down the road, my portfolio is there ready to go with me. The district pays for this one time per student as a fee as a whole district, and then it stays with them for life if they decide to update it at least once every 4 or 5 years. We tell them do it every year. You should be updating your resume no matter what. From that, we also decided this occupation part in their portfolio, whatever their choices, assessments, anything that they do with it, they then build a portfolio of favorites in there that says, these are jobs I'm interested in and this is why. What's great about it, as you see on the left side, we really use this whole tool of preparation of physical conditions, wages, helpful high school courses for us to build a 7th through 12th grade curriculum, which we just did last year, to say from 7th grade on, they will build to do a little bit of their career requirements per year. Instead of it strictly just being high school, our feeling was 7th and 8th grade, they at least start thinking about stuff. They like all of the cool little assessments, reality checks to see how much it costs to live and would their job they picked make it work. And more importantly, as an 8th grader, we wanted them to take that reality check because then it helps our counselors when they go to the eighth graders before they get into high school to saying, are there some job interests you're interested in? Your freshman and your senior year, those are the years you have the most electives. Let's get you in to look at some of those career options early instead of waiting to junior year and then they don't have time to do it. So this was important to us. And if you'll notice here, this is on automobile mechanics. They chose to pick that. They look at that. They put it in their favorites. What we've added is called the CIS Connection. And this is an additional software program that now takes a little deeper. I want to be an auto mechanic. Now I want to see who does that in my town and how I can maybe get an internship with them or a job shadow or something to help me see if I really want to get into this field. So we built this. We bought the CIS Connection, and if you'll notice here, we're just now building it. We started it in September. We have about 60 businesses online, and probably about, I think we figured 150 career tracks that those businesses help show an example for. So we're wanting to just keep building this. But the two, we have Independent Auto Works, and we have Malcolm's Auto Electric, that they said, yes, we want to get on board. Well, they do a simple page that gives, that the kid says, oh, I want to be an auto mechanic. They hit their CIS Connection, and now they're seeing in town, here's a company that's interested in possibly being an internship form or a job shadow, and what are some of the things that are important to them. As they get more involved, it shows soft skills that are important to this company, but this is just the first page of a two-page summary. So, our district made this commitment. They've had CIS for years. It costs $7,500 a year to pay for this program to be available for every student in our district. This is paid by the Perkins Grant. That's part of our CTE program, and it all fits in with career-related information. When we added the CIS Connection, and this was a long debate for about a half a year, the first year cost $7,500. Part of that was because there needed to be a lot of intensive training to learn not only how to set it up, but then know how to go out and sell it to a business. So that cost goes with the training. Once this year is over, then we're going to go, it'll be $3,000 per year. Right now, to do this first year, we had a compete grant that helped try to get some more career and technical information out there to students. It paid for the first year. It will then become a line item out of our general fund, or we're hoping to get the region back in it again, and like we did with CESD, and let it be a regional expense that we can share. That's our goal for making it show that we can still keep paying for this. The reason I feel like this is a nice blend between both legislature and the Department of Education is the biggest issue every district's having to deal with, and I know because I've gone to a lot of the meetings, is how do you keep track of this enormous requirement of career-related requirements? How do you know that you keep track of it both from a software program to be it on their transcripts? How do you know? Then we have kids that come into our school. Then they go, oh, yeah, I did that career stuff. Well, can you prove it? We have to call. We have to get a file sent. Or we have to talk to that career or advisor. It's very, very time-consuming, and yet you can't verify it because it's not on a virtual portfolio. A lot of the districts still do it as a hard copy, and you've got to track that down. Our feeling and philosophy is that the career requirements are great. It's really made a difference with the students, but somebody's got to make that commitment to say, let's come up with a software program that the whole state uses, the kids can transfer around, and that program goes with them. We don't care what it is, but why reinvent something that there's software programs out there? But don't make districts have to make that decision. Do we do the software program, or do we save a teacher's position? Because right now, it's put on each district to make that decision on their own. And that's why we feel like, make a commitment to career education. Somebody pay for it and keep it as a line item that's going to stay there so they know it's going to be tracked. That, and that it's going to be actual part of their transcript, and make that built into the software program. So I've got a story of why I really feel the career requirements are great. And it's called My Baker Story. So I started last year. Sophomores do a career shadow. This kid comes into my office absolutely upset with me. He's like, why are you telling me as a sophomore I've got to do a career shadow? I have no idea what I want to do. And I said, well, sit down. Let's talk about it. What do you do? Tell me, what do you do in your spare time? Not much. You know, I play video games. I do this. I do that. And I just kind of kept pulling at him and saying, tell me more. Tell me what interests you. What do you do in your spare time that you love to do? He finally mellowed out a little bit, and he's looking at me, and finally says, well, I cook. I said, okay, tell me about your cooking. Do you do it for your family? Do you do it on your free time? What do you do? And he goes, no. He goes, I kind of turned it into a hobby, and actually, I love to bake bread. So I'm like, okay, so this is an interest of yours. Then I think you need to do a job shadow with a baker. And he's like, I could use that as a job shadow. I go, of course, that's what you're interested in. We want you to follow your passion here. Let's get you lined up. I said, I'll help. I'll call around. I know some bakers in town. And come back in a couple of days. He comes back. Totally different kid. He's not upset with him anymore. Well, did you find me a baker? I said, yes, I did. But he wanted me to ask you two questions before you're to call him, because he's ready to take you. And he goes, okay, what's the questions? His questions were, do you want to be a window baker or a true baker? And the kid's looking at him going, I have no idea what that means. I go, well, I didn't either, so I asked him, okay, what does it mean? He goes, a window baker, I'll have him come in at 6 o'clock in the morning one morning, and I'll show him the bread, we'll get it all lined up in its packaging, we'll get it on the display, and he'll help me see how we sell it to the customers. He goes, but a true baker, he's going to be with me at 4 o'clock in the morning. So which job shadow does he want to do? The kid looks at me and he goes, oh my gosh, I want to bake the bread at 4 in the morning. And I said, okay, and then call him. Here's his number, here's his name. And I want to hear back when you do it. Come tell me how it went, because I'm excited to see how it goes. So I put a little note, okay, I got to keep track of this kid. So about 3 weeks later, he comes flying into my room. He goes, I baked bread. I said, okay. How was it? He goes, I learned how to do initiating, to know what is your true baking. I learned, he went on and on and on. I go, well, that is so great. I go, so now, are you going to write that reflection for me? He goes, oh, I already did it. And he goes, then I got to tell you something else. I go, okay. He goes, he liked me. And he goes, you're really into this, and you're a very good baker. How old are you? He goes, I'll be 16 next month. He goes, tell you what, when you turn 16, come see me. I've got a job for you. And the kid's like, you're kidding. You're really going to let me bake bread with you? I go, no, I'm serious. He goes, you're good. Your ethics is great. And it's obvious you love this. And so I said, okay, then let me know how it goes. At the end of school, he comes back to me and he goes, I've got my summer job all lined up. I'm baking bread and I'll bring you some in the fall. So I just tell you that there's tons of stories I can tell you, because as career educators, we go into the classroom, we take a group at a time, we take them wherever they are, as a freshman through a senior, and we help them see why that little component fits in with the next step, and we let them get those experiences. We resumes, everything. There's great stories to be told. So I just mainly wanted to say, I don't care what it is, but you need to understand that our district is very committed to career learning. Not every district is. I can tell you, some of it's just happening with barely an advisor one time a year that they go, okay, we got to do this, do a resume, and it's done. And then you have other districts that are very committed to this, and it takes lots of time to figure out a software program, to figure out how you're going to track it, and figure out who's going to teach it. So all that I ask is, how can we help? How can we say, legislature, Department of Education, work together, put some bucks behind it to say, let's come up with a plan that the whole state uses so they're not having to have those kind of discussions and decisions, and then watch what happens with the program. It can be CIS, it can be something else. We don't care. Just pick a system and then help make sure it stays in place so those kids can have that for life. So another thing, just as a point, we're having a mock interview on April 23rd. It's going to be part of your handouts. If you truly want to have an amazing event and learn to see what kids have to say in mock interviews, we need 160 of them. We're going to have 800 kids with six high schools all meeting together. We're going to have 60 professional business booths where they can go as one of the rotations. They have to listen to them and then help ask questions, and then they have two interviews. So if you want to come join us, we'd love to have you come see us. It's going to be at OSU. It's going to host it. And I have some papers for you to hand out, but questions?
Are there questions for Donna? Representative Riblin.
I actually just want to make a comment.
Okay.
And that is, Representative Clem, who used to be on our committee, his mother did your job in the high school that I worked at. So I am excited to see another person as enthusiastic as she was, because I think there is no substitute for enthusiasm in helping kids find their passions. And it's one of the things that really I think all great teachers possess is that enthusiasm about what they do. And it's obvious from your presentation that that's there. And I guess the other question that I would ask you, do you have them do the CIS questionnaires that help move them and let them know what they are interested in?
Yes.
Because I found that one of the really great pieces of CIS was
And we start that in seventh grade. Okay. What we do is seventh grade, we have two goals. Get them plugged in so that they know they truly have a username and password that stays with them. And we made it very consistent so it didn't matter where they moved to. And then the second part is they do a reality check, which is an amazing program that they've just added. But then we also have them do the inside profiler. And that's the one that first starts asking them, what do you like, what do you do? It's 182 questions. From that, it gives them their top five occupation fields. And immediately we have them save that in their portfolio. So you're going to add more. You're going to do more assessments as you go through, but we start that in seventh and eighth grade.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Thatcher.
I loved your presentation. And just for clarification, were we talking about 2419 or was it just this informational?
This is an informational hearing.
Okay, thank you, because I was trying to draw.
I don't even know.
It was
healthy bread. Okay. Very healthy bread.
Yeah, baking bread.
No. This is great. I think the schools need to definitely look at vocational tracks, definitely, which may or may not include a four-year college degree.
Right.
And so I think it's great. But I'm wondering how you would answer those who say, well, another state mandate, you know, maybe some school districts say, we can't afford to do this, we can't do it.
Right.
So if it's a good idea, then maybe, you know, sell it to the school districts individually and saying this is, I'm just wondering how you would respond to that type of.
Well, I can answer that because I've been watching and listening to that for the last 10 years in our district. First, you've got to make that commitment as a district. But the part that's why I think it's something that's got to go at a higher level than those districts making those decisions is if it's truly going to be a commitment for a state to say this is important, then it's got to be at that level that you make that commitment. If you're asking individual districts to say, not only do you want you to come up with a plan, we want you to track all these kids, and then you're going to verify it on their transcript, why would they want to do that? They're already overloaded. But if it's a state responsibility that says, hey, this is important, we're making the commitment not only with giving you a tracking system that works, but we're going to help pay for it so that we know these kids can move from district to district, and it's in place, then you're not having that district go, oh, I'm not going to do this. I can tell you, even at our own school, pre us being hired, there was about 20% of the advisors that got it and actually did the career requirements. The other 80% were like, okay, read this, you're done. You know that. So if you're going to have that mentality of that's the importance to that teacher, how is that going to be important to that kid? Now that you've got career counselors back in that's saying, okay, guys, not only are you going to do this, we're going to come in and teach it to you, show you how to use the software, and it's for life, that this will help you with your career. All of a sudden, they're like, oh, my gosh, this is great. And as I go to businesses to get them hooked on, their first question is, how come we didn't have this 20 years ago when I was in school? I want to be able to have a way that I can track when I go to my next career.
And so to clarify, Donna, the requirement to do the career education and track these things is already there.
Yes.
But shockingly, because we've never done this before as a state, we mandated something and did not back it up with resources or tools in order to make it happen.
I know, it's a first. But I'm just saying, you have to think about that because it's very time conducive. We're committed and we've spent mega hours doing it. What is happening to that district that doesn't care?
Representative Reblin.
Clarification then, and thank you, Madam Chair. CIS is produced by?
It's housed out of University of Oregon. It's its own entity. It's a company called Career Information Systems. There's a fee cost that goes with it. 85% of the state already uses it because it's such a great tool and it's updated every year.
And follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
And originally that came from, I think, maybe even Perkins at the beginning.
That I don't know.
Community colleges and others. I mean, I think it was kind of produced by the state.
Right, right. It's a wonderful tool. And
it's developed over time.
Yes. In fact, it started, I asked the history about it as part of our training. It started as a graduate doctoral program at University of Oregon that wanted to somehow mesh the Department of Labor with career options. And that started 35 years ago.
And so for the record, we have someone from Corvallis giving kudos to something that came out of the University of Oregon. It does happen.
I won't wear green and yellow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. And, you know, first of all, I want to also express my appreciation for your presentation. When a student says that he or she wants to be a baker or, you know, whatever, is there information given them as to whether or not this is going to lead to a family wage job? You know, I mean, yeah. Are they given some help in terms of, you know, this might be something I'm interested in, maybe I want to be a cosmetologist or something, but just recognizing that ultimately that may not be a sustainable job.
Yes, and that's part of what CI does for us. It's got hundreds of occupations on there that are updated. It talks about the physical conditions. It talks about the actual course requirements. I mean, it gives them the very realistic viewpoint. And for some of those kids to realize, oh, my gosh, you mean I have to go to school for that? I mean, other than I just want to do it.
Right.
So it helps answer a lot of those questions. And then we have they reflect each year as they do it a little bit what I call deeper assessment to start realizing realistically what can they do of what they'd like to do versus what can they afford and how can we make that happen.
Mm-hmm. And then related, actually, to the point that you just made, let's say a person decides they want to be an auto mechanic,
mm-hmm.
right, an auto technician. So, you know, we know, I assume that Lynn Benton Community College has a program, or let's assume that it does, mm-hmm. in auto mechanics. Then would they be given that information and then find out what it would take for them to, you know, what performance level they would need to be at when
mm-hmm.
they graduate from high school so that they could go seamlessly into that program?
In fact, I just set up last week, I have four internships of students that are 17, and they're in actual, those two that I showed you, Malcolm's Auto and some of the other places in town, that they're doing their internship to give them even more experience so that they can get into that program when they graduate as a senior. But that they get that chance to do it even more. But we have them all the time where we have speakers coming in and we also take them to field trips. Part of the career day is we'll have representatives there on that April 23rd where they can ask, how do I get into this program to make sure that I can do it?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Dimmer. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, if I may?
Of course.
Thanks. Love the bread story.
Yeah.
Do you have data on the adoption rate? How many of the kids that you would anticipate using it, use it? How often they use it? Things like that.
In terms of CIS or the connection part?
CIS is what I was thinking, but either one would be of interest.
We have just started that. Part of, you know, remember we first had a year of trying to convince the district this is the way to go because we were trying to build our own.
Mm-hmm.
So some of it is we've got a whole year under our belt that we've used it. But it does have a tracking system as part of that not only can you track it, how many use it, in what mm-hmm. way, but the businesses, and this is what a selling point for CIS Connect, is the businesses. A perfect example, Pepsi is in our in Corvallis. They really encourage volunteers to go out and do their employees to do volunteer work. By them signing up into CIS Connection, that keeps track for that company, every volunteer that goes out there for them, how often, what they did, and that way they can use it as part of their yearly reports besides just that individual person saying, this is the volunteer work that I did. So the mechanisms are there. We haven't even gone through a full year yet to then use that as part of our summary statistics. But it's set up that you can do that.
Okay, good. Yeah, it would be very interesting to see
mm-hmm.
how much utilization it's getting.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one, just clarification on some finances. I think you said it was $7,500-ish a year
right.
for just the CIS and
right.
then $7,500 first year, $3,000 second year, subsequent
right.
years for the CIS. And that's per district?
Well, for just our district. We have 6,770 students in our district. So that's $7,500. And I think it has a figure amount depending on how large your school
okay.
is.
And
that's for our size of a district.
And you said that 85% of the state school districts currently use it?
Yes.
Okay. thanks.
So if it was a state issue where you could lobby for a reduced rate,
yeah.
You know.
I assume they're hosting this for you and you're just hitting a website, correct?
Right.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Representative Parker. Representative Roblin.
This goes back to Representative Dembrough's question. When they get a profile, it'll tell them that, say, hospitality, a large group. And
right.
In that, they'll list a whole lot of jobs.
Right.
And it does give the range of salaries you could expect in each one of those
yes.
portions of that. So they could decide that they want in hospitality to just be a waitress or a waiter.
Right.
And it might say that you're going
right.
to make this much. But you could be the restaurateur, or you
exactly.
could be. And it'll show you the different kinds of things.
Right.
Correct?
In fact, each one, as they go into the main page that looks at the occupations, like say if they want to be a dancer and they go in there, it'll show them three or four versions saying the overview will be under this category, but you can also look at just a specific type of dancer. So it breaks it down real detailed and to try to get it as specific as it can be for that particular interest.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for Donna? No. Donna, thank you very much
You're
for
welcome.
Coming today. And colleagues, I think that this was a fun thing to do today. It's something really positive that's happening out in our districts and in our schools. I got to spend part of this morning in a local K-8 where the kids were doing a sesquicentennial activity. They did murals and a history of the state of Oregon, each of the kids from kindergarten through eighth grade. And we have really great things happening in our schools right now, and the work is continuing despite the tremendous stress that the districts are under with the uncertainty they face about what's going to happen next in the school year. So I just want to thank you and your colleagues for just continuing the positive and optimistic efforts, even when everything else seems pretty overwhelming right now, I'm sure.
Thank you. And the two handouts, one is to show you how we've split up our curriculum 7th through 12th and what classes that they're being taught in, so that it's consistently happening over the 6 years. And the other one is just a summary of my presentation. So if you want to get a hold of me, it's on there.
And one other comment just to that. And you mentioned Perkins, and I think almost all of the districts that actually purchase this do it through Perkins funds, which is a federal fund
right.
issue,
right.
and they are limited in what you can spend it for. And
right.
of all of the things you can spend it for, Perkins, this one covers the most kids because
right.
it really is an opportunity for everybody. And some of the Perkins money is more.
Right. And it seems like for our district, you figure.
Can you make sure you're speaking into the microphone so that we get it for the
okay.
record? Thanks.
Part of it is. You figure 6,700 kids in our district and 7,500, you know, you're talking a little over a dollar a kid. And when you start thinking about that cost, and they're getting a portfolio that stays with them for life to help them with all their career transitions, that's pretty cheap.
And they don't have to pay any
nope.
teacher.
Nope.
Right?
Once they're on and they're logged on, their host school, be it a high school, community college, or college, continues that for them. And they can just plug back into that place that's hosting it for them.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you. And I'm going to close the informational hearing on career education technology and move back into our public hearing on House Bill 2419. Do we have others that are signed up to speak? I'm guessing we do, as I can guess which ones of you there are. So I would like to call Doreen Powers, please. Welcome, Doreen. And if for the record, you'll just state your name and proceed.
My name's Doreen Powers from Beaverton.
Welcome.
This is my first time ever doing anything like this, so... So, Chair Gelster, thank you for allowing me to testify in favor of House Bill 2419. As I said, my name is Doreen Powers. I'm a fourth-grade teacher at Butternut Creek Elementary School in the Hillsborough School District. House Bill 2419 corrects an unintended consequence of the earlier bill, House Bill 2650. That bill benefits school children by applying high nutritional standards to foods and beverages sold to children at school. It holds these foods to a strict but fair fat, sugar, and calorie count. While I support the general intent of House Bill 2650, there is one provision that I feel had the unintended effect of restricting the food choices of adults working at schools. Ironically, House Bill 2650 suspends the nutritional standards, quote, at times when the school is being used for events for which parents and other adults are a significant part of an audience or are selling food or beverage items before, during, or after the event. It appears to me that the authors of the bill recognize that the proposed standards may be too restrictive for adults, but they fail to recognize that adults working at the school alongside students may have the same expectations of choice. When teachers have occasion to go to our district office or education service district, we notice that those employees have more access to myriad food choices. This law confuses me and the teachers I spend my day with. It unintentionally treats us the same as children. We are adults and able to make choices, good or bad, just like any other adult. Since the time that the vending machines were taken out of our building, teachers have adjusted by bringing their snacks from home. However, we remain resentful. Students are not allowed in the staff lounge and have never had access to what is kept there. We would like the ability to choose for ourselves restored. This bill would simply fix the technical problem in the law. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Powers? Representative Huffman.
Madam Chair, I just have a comment. I must confess I've been listening to the testimony this afternoon and admittedly was daydreaming from the Baker story in the earlier work session. And speaking of career paths, I just wanted to share that in 1970, going into the gymnasium, there was a food vending machine, and Plantation put out the best blonde brownie. And as a 15-year-old, I absolutely loved that blonde brownie. And a year later, I actually became the baker in that example of that story, making bread in the morning on a cooperative occupational education story. And I felt compelled to share that with everybody.
I appreciate that. And maybe on Monday you can bring us all some blonde brownies.
There you go.
Are there
the career tie-in, though, right?
I did. That was okay. Very good. Okay. That was very good. Thank you for sharing. Representative Roland.
Thank you. First, I want to say, very good job of testifying.
Oh, thank you.
And I hope that we see you more often.
I'll be retiring in a couple of years. So.
And once you get used to this, it's a really great thing to do, and come and let us know your opinions. We always like to have people and constituents come and actually spend some time telling us their opinion. And I think that there are times when there is a difference between being a child and being an adult. And I would hope, and when I listened to this bill last time, I never thought the intention was to close down the choices that adults make and in their food choices. I make lots of bad choices with respect to my own food.
And I would say that the teachers I know are very careful about not doing inappropriate things
in front of their children.
Their students.
And that was kind of where I was going to lead to. So
thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Am I excused? Great. Well, I think Representative
Maurer
has a question for you.
No, Madam Chair, I guess I come to this somewhat skeptical. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. Is smoking permitted on your campus?
No.
It's an adult activity, and maybe not in a teacher's room, but we could make a closed-off area so students can see you smoke. It doesn't prohibit you from bringing your snacks and your pop to school. It's just about the vending machine, and we're going to prohibit the sale of a vending machine for cigarettes in bars where adults go. It's the conflicting signals here are just.
Do I get to speak again?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
that's okay.
I'm commenting to allow you to respond to my little dialogue.
The main idea that I'd like to express is the feeling of resentment that I come here to the Capitol and see people who are concerned about the welfare of all Oregonians, go to the coffee shop downstairs and see all of the wonderful things that are offered to the adults that work here. And I see that you're all using good judgment and not, well, except for the chocolate, which I enjoy very much, are using good judgment about when and where you're eating that. I think I speak for many other teachers when I say that we work with children all day, we value children, we cherish them, but we are adults, and we want to be treated just like you're treated. We want to be able to have the choice. And personally, I don't really care if we ever get the Coke machines back in our building. I care, though, that I have the same rights as other adults in the workplace.
Thank you. Are there other further comments, Ms. Mauer?
Well, I guess I have problems with this because the mixed signals are just astounding, because we're now going back to change state law on an issue that was very, very, very widely publicized, and I clearly think the intent was the intent at the time. So.
Thank you, Representative Rowland.
I'm not sure that any discussion was the intent with respect to the faculty rooms and the working conditions of teachers. But, and I'll go back to the cigarette and the smoking. There were many years, as Representative Thatcher pointed out, that smoking was allowed in staff rooms, and that was a battle that took a number of years and decisions for people. But at the time we started banning it in schools, we were also starting to ban it in other public buildings. And I mean, I think that's a decision that society has made over time. In our school, at the high school level, those become internal battles with students who start thinking of the same thing that Representative Mauer is saying. And so we had more than numerous occasions when our student body would have conversations with the school board about those kinds of conversations. But it was an adult conversation. And I guess what I'm saying is it took time for the society. And when we were talking about this bill, we were talking about moving society to make better choices, and it wasn't about controlling adults in those situations. And I guess I'd like you to respond to that, too.
Well, I have so many things swirling in my mind, but it seems to me I remember reading in that House Bill 2650 that the standards were different dependent on grade level, so that the elementary schools had, like, the least calorie and fat content, and going up the line where the students are more adult-sized, that increased. So what does it leave the teachers at the elementary school then if we have to follow that standard? It really seems to me, and I was under the impression from talking to some people that were involved with the bill, that it never really intended to affect teachers in this way. And so when you talk about what's good for the goose is good for the gander, I assume you're talking about teacher versus student. I see goose versus gander as school employees versus all the other employees. And I agree with you. What's good for the goose is good for the gander in my frame of mind.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for Ms. Powers? No, thank you very much for coming to testify today. You've done a good job presenting your position.
Thank you.
Could I also have Lori Wimmer and Joel Glick next, please?
My name is Joel Glick. I am one of two English as a second language teachers in the Lake Oswego School District. I've been teaching in Oregon Public Schools for 17 years. I also serve on the OEA Board of Directors representing the Three Valley Unisert District. Chair Gelser and honorable members of the House Education Committee, I come before you this afternoon well aware of the many important and urgent issues that the Oregon Legislature must address this session. The matter that I'm addressing might seem trivial or insignificant in comparison with many others. However, I respectfully request your consideration of what I believe to have been an unintentional injustice against educational employees committed during the previous legislative session. The injustice that I'm referring to was the failure to exempt employee areas from the provisions of House Bill 2650, which, among its many provisions, places restrictions on the sales of soft drinks, fruit juices, and snack foods in our public schools. As a teacher who works at a high school, a junior high school, and three elementary schools, I believe that I can offer you a rather unique perspective on this issue. I begin my work day every morning at Lake Oswego High School. I'm really not the kind of guy who drinks soda pop first thing in the morning. But on occasion, I used to purchase a can of Cherry Coke or Sprite from the vending machine in the Lake Oswego High School staff lounge when I was working in the buildings in the late afternoons, in the evenings, or when I came in on the weekends. The vending machine in the Lake Oswego High School staff lounge, however, no longer offers regular Cherry Coke or Sprite. Rather, it only offers artificially sweetened soft drinks like Diet Coke, Diet Sprite, or Fresca, which, unfortunately, I can't stand. My next stop every morning is at Lake Oswego Junior High School, where there is no longer a soft drink vending machine in the staff lounge. My third stop on most days, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, is at Uplands Elementary School, where there is still a soda machine in the staff lounge. That machine, however, stands empty and unplugged, an unfortunate victim of HB 2650. So, why are diet soft drinks being sold at the high schools and not at the elementary and junior high school staff lounges? The answer is that HB 2650 permits the sale of 12-ounce cans of fruit juice and no-calorie or low-calorie soft drinks in high schools, but prohibits the sale of those same products in elementary and middle schools. Now, I am well aware of the health risks associated with the overconsumption of fruit juice and soft drinks, be they naturally or artificially sweetened. And I agree that we need to limit the size of servings of fruit juice that are offered to children in our public schools. I also agree that we should not promote the consumption of sugary soft drinks by high school students. In fact, I support all of the provisions of HB 2650 as they apply to elementary, middle, and high school students. I believe that we have a responsibility to assure that the food and drinks that we sell to students are healthful, nutritious, and non-fattening. However, I do not believe that in enacting HB 2650, it was ever the intention of the legislature or the governor to prohibit the sales of soft drinks, fruit juices, and snack foods to school employees. I can assure you that the staff lounges in Lake Oswego are completely off limits to students. And I believe that in most of the schools throughout the state, students are not allowed in staff lounges or lunchrooms. Therefore, on behalf of Principal Karen Lockman, the teachers, and the classified employees at Uplands Elementary School, as well as the members of the Lake Oswego Education Association and the Oregon Education Association, I respectfully urge the House Education Committee to approve HB 2419, sponsored by Representative Greenlick. Among its other provisions, HB 2419 defines employee areas and exempts those employee areas from the restrictions on sales of food and beverages contained in HB 2650. Teachers and other educational employees work very hard, and when on occasion we forget to pack a can of juice or soft drink in our lunch boxes, we really don't have time during the half-hour lunch break that we receive to drive back and forth to 7-Eleven to pick one up. Likewise, when we're working in our buildings in the late afternoons, evenings, or on the weekends, it is much more convenient for us to buy a can of juice, soft drink, or other snack from a vending machine in our staff lounge rather than have to leave the building to do so. The passage of 2419 will represent an acknowledgement by our elected representatives that school employees are adults who are capable of deciding for ourselves whether or not we want to purchase a 12-ounce can of soda, fruit juice, or snack, regardless of whether we work in a high school, middle school, or elementary school. Once again, I'd like to thank Chair Gelser and the House Education Committee members for your time and attention to this issue.
Thank you.
Lori. Good afternoon, Chair Gelsler and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing Oregon Education Association's 48,000 employees. And we are here in support of the bill as well because we perceive it to be primarily a housekeeping measure. We think it will bring clarity to the original intent of the nutrition standards, which we support, and will also cure what I consider a problem of mission creep. What I mean by that is it seems that both the department, in going a bridge too far in writing regulations, and by opponents of this measure who appear to want to regulate the food choices of just one subset of adults in Oregon, have gone a little bit farther than it was intended when that law was passed last session. Our members work long hours, as you've heard, and however unfortunate, may not always have the time to go shopping or pack a lunch or what have you. Many hours early in the morning, sometimes, you know, dark 30 in the morning, they get there, and dark 30 at night, they leave, and nights and weekends are not uncommon, and if on occasion they want to grab a bag of peanuts or a juice or, yes, maybe even a cookie, it shouldn't be a legislative issue. It just shouldn't, and it would be really great to be able to, among all the very important things you're doing this session, take a minute or two to just clarify that was never the intent. And to allow this small thing to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel, Representative Thatcher?
I was just watching Representative Harker wave his hand down there frantically, but anyway, here. we're in school today. We're passing notes and everything. Andy, you know. I just wondered, when this bill came forth in 2007, Did the OEI, I didn't see you on the list of people who, you know, here,
yeah,
that were in favor of this, but did you just not notice or think about that particular outcome from this bill, or what was...
Madam Chair and Representative Thatcher, we were informed that this was around the nutrition choices of the students in Oregon schools, not the adults, and so we didn't come in and go out of our way to position on that because it wasn't an issue for us to do that. We didn't expect we didn't anticipate that the regulation would go beyond what the legislature wrote in its law.
Just a follow-up. It does say the schools, though, doesn't it? I mean, it does say this: what's sold in the schools, period, and the teachers work in the schools, so I guess I was wondering. I wasn't here during testimony, but I remember the bill vividly, and I just, do you think it's a good thing to have two different standards when we're talking about supposedly examples for the children and role modeling and all that?
Madam Chair and Representative Thatcher, I think you have the opportunity to be a role model by the actions that you carry forward in front of students. And in a faculty lounge, we're simply not talking about actions in front of students. And we are talking about adults. And on the day that we regulate what all adults eat, I suppose that might have a beneficial effect on the diets of kids. I'm a mom, and I certainly understand that point of view. But that wasn't the intent originally, as it was represented to us by the makers of the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Just a comment. I see this coming. I agree that we shouldn't be regulating the behavior of adults in certain fashions, but it just seems like we do come up with a lot of bills to do just that, and it's okay when it comes to maybe smoking or, you know, other behaviors, but it, yeah, like I said, anyway, I just see a double standard going on in the building, not only in this bill, but overall. So.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You just said faculty lounge or something. I've heard faculty and staff and adult and employee used somewhat interchangeably, but I think, here we go, the bill specifies employee area. Are all adults in the school permitted access to this employee area? Because otherwise I envision the volunteers, of which there are many, wanting their own machine next.
Representative, or Chair Gelsler and Representative Harker, I can't speak for every single school in the state, but I can tell you that at the schools that I've worked in, both in Lake Oswego and I used to work here in Salem, I don't remember other adults coming into the faculty lounge or the staff lounge unless they were invited for one reason or another. For example, once in a while they come in to serve us food, and they're always welcome to do that. But otherwise, generally parents are not, that is not where they eat lunch.
Quick follow-up. But are all, thanks, and that is what I was after now, I'm just wondering, are all adult employees of the schools permitted in this area?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good.
Right.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Maurer.
Two points. Number one, at my son's middle school, before the open hours of, you know, control of campus, the only way to get into the office is through the teacher's lounge. Kids routinely go through the teacher's lounge to get to the office because that is the only door that's open and it's controlled and there's people there, but that's the only way. The other point is, and the reason is kind of excites me, I sit on health care, I sit on human services, and we've got bills that are going to eliminate vending machines, tobacco vending machines, in the state of Oregon, period. Bar none, out of bars, and I'm going to support that. I'm going to support it. I'm telling you, I am conflicted because the stars are just coming zooming every which way, and I feel like we're not threading the needle. We're just picking and choosing our issues without really stepping back and say, what's the greater consequence of the freedom of, essentially a freedom of expression, freedom of what you put in your body. We're not prohibiting them from bringing this stuff to school. It's just, it's the vending machine, and it's like, so now we have to sign a contract with Pepsi or Coke or whoever to bring in the vending machine. Who gets the money?
Madam Chair, Representative Merritt, actually in the past that was schools that made money off of those vending machines. Mm-hmm. That was part of the difficulty, I think, originally around that, because a lot of administrators used it as a supplementary income source. So, but more to the point about cigarettes, one point I would like to make that it is not a perfect analogy to the snack and beverage machines, and this is why. First of all, cigarettes are illegal for use by minors, and they are not for adults in this state. And secondly, the secondhand smoke issue has always been a concern. And so I think those two things, I mean, you don't get secondhand sugar contamination if somebody's eating a piece of Representative Roblin's chocolate, for example. So,
okay.
Well, thank you. Are there other comments for this panel? I would jump in on the issue of the cigarettes. I think the difference here is that drinking the soda or eating the candy bar is not prohibited in the lounge in which this would be sold. However, the cigarettes are, you can't smoke them anyplace anymore that is a public place. So why would you buy them there instead of going to a store unless you were an underage person that was trying to skirt the law and get your cigarettes without having to show your ID? So you couldn't purchase the cigarettes and use them in a bowling alley or a bar or a lounge because you can't do that anymore. Thank you. Tricia Smith.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Yes, Representative Thatcher.
I'm wondering if there's anybody on the list or anybody in the audience may speak to the effectiveness of, maybe it's just too soon to tell, of the bill that we implemented last session. Is it? Yeah. Okay. That's
All right. For the record, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I wish I could say that I'm happy to be here, but this is an issue that I thought I had dodged. I say that, Madam Chair, to tell you in full disclosure that it is my bad that I did not testify on this issue in 2007 when this bill was debated. I understood from the proponents and my obviously cursory reading of the bill that the bill was about regulating what children eat at school. My members felt strongly both ways about the issue. Some of them believed that we ought to outlaw McDonald's, things in boxes, all sorts of things related to bad nutrition. Some of them reminded me that there are nutritionists deciding what children eat in schools now. And why did we need a legislative fix to a problem that they didn't see? So, the committee that heard this bill did not hear me speak to it, which is why I'm with you today. Today, I'm here to ask you to please pass this bill, because, as someone said, if we want to regulate what adults eat, we should regulate what all adults eat, or maybe what all adults eat at work, if we want to regulate what adults eat at work. But I don't think the legislature really wants to engage that discussion. And that's the discussion that you are in kind of a back doorway having if you don't move this bill. And I'd rather you have a straight-on discussion, because I kind of like the no-boxed food, no drive-through window food idea. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for this witness? It appears there are not. You have dodged that bullet.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That exhausts my list of people who have signed up. Are there others in the room that wish to testify? Is there another sheet?
There should be.
All right, but go ahead and come on up.
I did it online.
It might be on the sheet for the other one, but come up, please come join us.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Becker, and I teach nutrition in the chemistry department at PSU, and public health nutrition in the School of Community Health at PSU. I'm chair of the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance. I was chair of the group that advocated for the passage of HB 2650, which set standards for foods sold in Oregon's public schools outside of the National School Lunch Program. In addition, I served on the Diabetes Task Force that you created last session. So thanks for the opportunity to give some perspective on the issues of selling soda and large portion sizes of snack foods in teacher lounges. True, the original intent of the bill was to address food and beverages sold to students, not adults. When asked, that's what I testified to some of you in 2007. The first phase of the new law began implementation in September of 2008 with fairly good compliance all around the state. What a victory. You, the Oregon legislature, got the worst offenders out of the school food environment. Vending machines now have lower calorie, smaller portion size foods for sale, thanks to your leadership. A reminder, the law only applies to food sold in schools. Anyone, students or teachers or administrative staff, can bring in any food or beverage they wish. So ODE, the Department of Education, upon reviewing the law, decided that the implementation of these nutrition standards would apply to the whole school, including the adult areas. Our group, the ONPA, was surprised but pleased. ODE got it. The school environment should be consistent in its rules about the availability of poor nutrition foods. Teachers would be role models for students, and the new rule would benefit adults as well. I'm a teacher and a proud member of AFT. I know the long hours and the stress that goes into teaching, and I know the comfort of food. But I also know that there is no shortage of places to purchase junk food. Adults can purchase soda pop and other snack items in many places, often less than a block away from schools. A person can still bring a six-pack or a case of pop or a package of chips into the teacher's lounge if they want to. Chips and large cookies are not scarce in our society. 2650 in no way limits food that a person can bring into school if they want a snack or a beverage. If this law is passed, it will be turning the clock backwards. You've heard many times over about the obesity epidemic. 66% of Oregon adults are overweight or obese. Oregon lawmakers are looking for ways to reverse the spread of obesity, especially in ways that do not call for more taxpayer money. Large portion size, high calorie, low nutrition foods are out of the schools, thanks to you. Does this committee really want to pass a law that makes it easier for people to have access to junk? Do we need a law to enable people, to make it easier for people to consume high-calorie foods? The Diabetes Task Force that I was a member of urged that workplaces enact wellness policies as a step towards fighting diabetes and obesity. Passage of this bill would almost be like enacting an unwellness policy for schools and would undermine schools' attempts to set the example for wellness and healthy eating. I don't think that rescinding or rolling back a wellness policy in the worksite is the right to do in the light of the obesity epidemic for Oregonians. It's kind of like a case of the right hand working against the left hand. So I urge you to vote no on this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Becker. Are there any questions for this witness? Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe it's been too soon since it's been fully implemented. Have we seen any results from the students as to any improvement in the things you're targeting in the original bill?
Well, we never anticipated that in, 9 months, children would get thinner. But it's been happening in schools. I mean, schools have complied relatively well. Kids are used to the new regime, and it doesn't seem to be too much of a problem. At least we haven't heard of any problems, and we've been asking. Okay. So it's becoming the new norm.
Okay.
That it's just smaller sizes and some limits on fat and sugar.
Follow-up? Is it your... I kind of think I heard this from you. Is it your contention that the adults were considered part of this bill all along?
No. Honestly, we didn't really think too much about it. I'll be very honest with you. Okay. ODE provided guidance, and that's the guidance that ODE put on it. And as I said, we were thrilled that they saw fit to have the schools be consistent.
One more question.
Of course.
I was just wondering about, we were talking about adults. What constitutes an adult? I'm assuming 18 and over. Some students are 18. And also, so if we rolled this back, that would also mean that maybe perhaps they would be included in access to vending machines.
I think it's the word students. It's not adults. It was directed towards students.
Okay.
We don't say directed towards non-adults.
No, I understand, but there was...
It's not an age.
I guess in previous testimony talking about we shouldn't be regulating what adults do or not do, so that was just kind of, the overarching principle, and therefore I was asking about that. You're probably the wrong person to ask, so since that's I understand your position. Thanks.
Nutritionist, not a lawyer.
Wonderful. Any further questions? Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your testimony, I heard you really talking about that your association is urging people to have conversations about wellness in the workplace. That's part of your organization's goal is to continue to have conversations in all workplaces about nutritional eating and that kind of stuff. And I guess from my perspective, this one is just says in your workplace you're going to be treated different than any other workplace because the government says it. Whereas having conversations and having school districts have real conversations with their staffs about wellness programs, I think, is an essential thing that we should all be doing. But that includes having them have the conversation about it so that we really get people bringing appropriate foods in, as opposed to just, like you were talking about, as opposed to just having this artificial one that says this stuff isn't going to be in the room. Because what we found, and I guess I will ask you that, what we found is when we started having those conversations, what was requested in the faculty room was water, and other kinds of things, and people were starting to make some of those choices. When you put in this particular law, I think it took people by surprise, and they say that they should have some control over their workplace. It didn't give them that opportunity to have that conversation. So from my perspective, because I think it was unexpected, it is, in fact, what we should do is to try to fix those things and then work towards that as we do it together. Do you have any comments about that?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what you meant by having conversations around wellness. I do know that as a matter of public policy, the Diabetes Task Force has suggested, matter of fact, they suggest that the governor make an executive order to have strong wellness policies in state agencies in this biennium. So I don't know if you call a school a state agency, but that is the direction that public health policy is going in, is trying to make the workplace more healthful places. Because we can't regulate what people eat. And you've heard this from several people. We can't tell people what to eat. We can make it easier for people to make healthy choices, make the healthy choice the easy choice. And that's the spirit behind this bill, is to make it easy to make a healthy choice. So if you want a snack, you can have a little snack. But you don't have to fight your way through the big cookies and the massive drinks to get a little snack of something. That's the spirit behind this, to make the healthy choice the easy choice.
Thank you. And just colleagues, I want to remind you, we have another bill and a number of people that have traveled quite a ways to testify, so we need to start
Last short follow-up.
Short follow-up.
The difference, as the one person explained, between the requirements for high school and middle school, whatever, leaves the elementary teacher with a different choice than a high school teacher. Is that...
The portion sizes aren't that small in the elementary school. It's an 8-ounce glass juice or a 100-calorie package of cookies. It's not like a little jar of baby food. I mean, it's
there's no diet soda, correct?
There's no diet soda in elementary and middle schools, but they're free to bring the diet soda in with them.
Thank you. Are there any last quick questions? Thank you very much.
I do have the strategic plan for diabetes, okay, if anybody's interested in that.
That would be great. Thank you. And Morgan Allen, I understand, is there anyone else that wants to be heard on this bill that we have missed? Thank you. Welcome, Morgan.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and I am the Switzerland of this issue. I could not be more neutral on this bill. And I did not intend to speak, but I just, because it's come up a little bit in some of the testimony, and some of the folks in the back of the room have been asking me about this, I just wanted to put on the record and clarify that the Department of Education did not make some sort of administrative rule interpretation on the law that was passed during the last session. There's no currently no flexibility or rule making authority for us to exempt the break rooms. The law is very clear that it covers the faculty lounges or teacher break rooms. So I just wanted to put that on the record, that there was not some sort of interpretation by our legal folks. It's very clear in the law and very clear in the bill that passed last session.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Allen? No? Seeing none? Any further comments before we move into work session on this bill, on the public hearing part? No, there are... Okay. So I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2419, and I am opening a work session on House Bill 2419. Representative Springer.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2419 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Springer moves that House Bill 2419 move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Springer.
I made some notes during the testimony, and I was thinking of had a few thoughts. I've spent a tremendous amount of time in my sixth grader's school since he was in kindergarten, and I remember when this bill came through, and I was actually on a school board at that time, and the strife that was caused, quite frankly, by the adults in the building when this occurred, and the vending machines in the staff lounge and those issues. And it strikes me as odd the conversation around the vending machines yet, and I have contributed to it, walking into that same staff lounge, and literally the table is covered with cookies and treats and such, because it was a way for us as parents to bless and to do something for these teachers. And I guess I see this, and maybe I'm taking a different view than some of my colleagues here. I see this as an opportunity in these really difficult times in schools. Very difficult time right now, and I hear constant conversation from my districts that, fear. There's just fear in the school. And the adults in the school are very concerned, and I see this as an opportunity to relieve some pressure. And so, in that vein, I am going to be supporting this bill.
Are there further comments on Bill Representative Thatcher?
Well, I think this is kind of a do as I say, not as I do kind of situation, and I think if we're going to micromanage what schools should present for food and sell in their schools, it should be all or nothing.
Thank you. Any further comments?
Madam Chair, I will be a no. I mean, I recognize I have a minority position on this. I am in schools all the time when I'm in my district, with especially my kids' schools. I didn't have a teacher, and nobody complained. I don't think they had vending machines in the teacher's lounge anyway, so I haven't heard a single thing. The only thing I have heard, my sister teaches at West Albany, and she runs a school, snack bar. And the big issue there was that they had to take out their Costco muffins.
Right.
And that the revenues have gone down, but we had long conversations about how that was going to impact them, and they have made the adjustments, and she's never come back to me. No one has complained about it to me, and I'm going to stand a no, recognizing that I will be outvoted.
Thank you. Any further comments?
We'll do that in this session.
And so I would just like to add for the record, I've struggled with what to do with this bill when it's come here. House Bill 2650 was an excellent bill that was not easy to pass last session. Representative Kotek, Representative Bruhn provided tremendous leadership in helping us to combat the obesity epidemic. And the discussions were long. They were difficult. We talked about many aspects of that bill. Nancy Becker knows I will never look at a yogurt parfait the same way ever again. Anytime I'm in an airport, I think of Nancy because there are always yogurt parfaits there. But I think there are a couple of questions with this bill. One, I think that it is clear through all of those discussions, I can't remember ever talking about the teacher's lounge. I think that the discussion here is very clear today that it was never anyone's intention that the teacher's lounges be covered. I think Representative Thatcher makes good points about the do as I say, not as I do. But I also think it's very important, whether it was the department's intention or not, there are frequently times when we pass legislation and there is a clear legislative intent. And not just this department, but other agencies go and write rules that may be inconsistent with that intent. I think it's the responsibility of the legislature to come back and be clear every time about what that intent was to prevent that creep or that overreach in administrative rules to go beyond what it was that was intended by the legislature when passing legislation. And I'm not suggesting that there was any malicious intent, and clearly there was a reading of that bill, but I do not believe it was the legislative intent to cover the vending machines in staff rooms. So, Representative Roblin.
Because of the comments, I think that what we have to be clear of is that legislative intent is only taken into consideration when language is not clear. And when language is clear, it is the intent. So we need to be more careful about making sure that we write stuff that says exactly what we mean and not hold the agencies responsible for following what we write. And part of that has to do with when we are talking about things, we need to be talking clearly. And I think when we make the mistake, as Representative Greenlick came up here and clearly articulated that was not the intent of his bill, but the wording, and so that there are times when I think the intent is when rules are made that they've missed the intent and the language. But in this case, I looked at the bill again. I think the language is very clear, and we need to own up to making the change. So I just want to clarify that part.
And I think the one final comment that I wanted to make is that the obesity epidemic in our state and in our nation are very significant. They're very important. But I also hope that as we're talking with kids and helping them to make healthy food choices, that we are using words that encourage them to be healthy. And I think certainly as the mother of three girls, that pursuit of thinness is something that concerns me. Many of you have seen these Wii's and the Wii Fits, and I was alarmed to walk into the room and listen to my girls and others playing with that, trying to figure out if they exercised enough, if they could fall into the underweight category where we kind of measures your body fitness. So as we talk about obesity, we need to talk about body health, and that thinness itself is not the goal, because we drive other disorders, particularly in girls and young women. So with that, if there's no further discussion, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Yes.
Representative Cobb?
Aye.
Representative Miller?
No.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Van Orman?
Excused.
Vice Chair Denbrough?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
And Chair Gilson?
Aye. With the majority of votes required for passage, this motion will pass and move to the floor. And I will talk with Representative Greenlick and get back to all of you about a carrier. And so now I would like to thank you all for coming to participate in that discussion. And I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2380. And thank all of you that are here for your patience and waiting for the bill to come up. And I would invite Representative Beyer. I thought I saw you walk in. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. House Bill, I don't even know what it is, 2380, is a return of my bill from last session to create a task force to look at the use of computers in schools. We've added a little more language to talk about, digital electronic devices also, because we discovered last year that people are using iPods and a lot of other equipment to load homework on, send home with kids. And it started in my district with a one-to-one initiative through Apple, where we had a middle school that the students all have computers. It has been really successful, but I think through the district and through the program, and they'll be able to tell you how many years it's been running, but they've discovered that maybe there are other ways to use computers in school as opposed to lab, to the one-to-one initiative. There are more efficient ways. So the interest is getting a task force going, which is unfortunate we couldn't do it last time, because I think we are falling behind in providing this kind of equipment in schools for kids, and that we would like the department to work with the district on best practices for curriculum and in the school, work on bundling purchases to help districts afford equipment, looking for grants, and trying to not expect the district to pay for equipment, but to help us get it at a more affordable rate and get it into the school district so that there's more access. We're finding that a lot of the computers in the schools now are being tied up continuously for the testing that needs to be done, and there is very little time left for students to be able to access this equipment. So I think we need to make it more available to the students, and there are many other ways that we can go into this. And with that, I did bring some people from my district and one from the North Eugene district, a principal from there. So I will have them come up. I have Nancy Golden, who is the superintendent of schools in Springfield. I have Al King, who is on the school board in Springfield and who is a past sitting representative. And I have Colt Hill, who is the superintendent from Bethel School District. And I will let them talk to you about the bill.
Great. Thank you. And Mr. King, Ms. Golden, and Mr. Gill, if you'd come on up. Great. Thank you for coming, and thank you again for your patience in sitting through the other hearing.
Hello, Madam Chair. I'm Al King. I'm on the Springfield School Board, and I used to be honorable like you, but now. When we did the one-to-one initiative with Apple, we were a pioneer on that, and they gave us a very good deal. And it was really well-renowned and a very exciting event. And then as we saw the students get involved with it, we saw not only their performance rocket up, but we saw that they had a different learning style. Kids today want to learn on the computer more than they want to learn, you know, on textbooks. They were just really rabid to get on the website to learn more. This was a low-income school. We had 100% of the parents participated in doing the orientation with the students in terms of learning, you know, how to you know, be involved with that, and they've been very responsible. And we're really excited about the performance. Well, you know, in my circumstance as a school board member, I had a couple of concerns. One was equity, that, you know, if it's such a good deal, you know, how can we do it for the rest of the students, and what's the best way to do that? Also, that it looked like it would be something that is good for not just our district, but more schools and more districts, and that then you take a look at funding. And so then if our school district said, this is great, we're going to do it and spend our dollars in bringing that to the rest of the students of our district, then what if 2 years later or 4 years later, imagine if we had a budget, that then the state said we need to be doing that for all of our schools, and they came up with, you know, funding support for doing that. And our school district had already done that. We wouldn't be able to take advantage of that like others. Also, strategically, we want to have best minds come forward on this. When we first looked at it, it was a lot of, you know, hardware-based and what's the best way to go. But very quickly, when you get into this, then you realize that it's not just hardware. The entire curriculum, testing, you know, lesson programs, parent access to find out what's homework is there, you know, all of that was, it was the entire program. So it became very clear that very soon in our future, we're going to be seeing a transition from textbooks being the primary, lesson material to it being web-based and much stronger. So I'm pretty confident now that 10 years from now, if we're having a school district that's primarily textbook-based, that we're going to be kind of in the dark ages on that. Well, then the district asked me to participate in a conference sponsored by National School Board Association up in Seattle that dealt with technology in schools. And so I participated in that. One thing that I learned was that Oregon is very much in the dark ages on this. You know, almost everybody is way far ahead of us. And so we really have lost a couple of years in not having a task force, you know, that's been participating, because we want to have best minds to do this. I also was conscious that the textbook people need to be making this transition, you know, if they're going to be part of that. And they know that they need to do that, but at the same time, you know, they're kind of like Encyclopedia Britannica. We need to get there, but we've got all these books, we got all these salespeople, what are we going to do about that? Well, when I went to the conference, what I found was that the textbooks have been so reluctant to proceed that they virtually lost 40 to 60% of that market already. Other companies are stepping forward, and universities, so many people are stepping forward that invested hundreds of millions of dollars in web-based technology to provide learning, that textbook companies have already lost a large share of that, you know, future market. That I was really surprised at that. But that meeting, you know, was a big surprise in how far behind Oregon is, and many states have adopted it already, saying, you know, we're going to have it statewide, and there's different methods of doing that. I'd also like to point out that one of the best models that I saw there was actually up in the state of Washington, and they're not the farthest ahead on this, but that they were utilizing a consortium of organizations. So it wasn't just Washington Department of Education, it wasn't just districts, it was a consortium of all of the different players, so that they were finding the resources, you know, having the guidance, and so school districts would have a place to go, there'd be some state uniformity, there'd be resources, and so whatever style and best practice, let's say school districts wanted to do, that was available and there was, you know, support for that. And it wasn't that the state, you know, said, okay, we're going to do it and we're going to spend the money to do that. One of the things that is clear to me is that we will need the savings from textbook expenditures over time to be part of the funding base to be able to transition over, to web-based education. Also, just real quickly, because I know we're low, short on time, so I'll be stopping here and yield over to people who know a lot more than me. But it's come to my attention that currently there is a referral to Ways and Means, for fiscal, and that really is not the intention or the need. We really don't need to have, fiscal associated with that, and we don't really need to put it into Ways and Means and then have to fish it, back out of there over a fiscal. The people that want to see best practices, best strategy going forward in Oregon want to help in the process. We don't need to have mileage and hours, et cetera. So the work in supporting, the task force we're talking about here is pretty minor, clerical, and I think they'll be supported by ODE. And we've also coordinated with them in terms of this. So I'll yield now. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Golden.
Right. This is my sixth year in Springfield, and when I first came, we did a community engagement process. We're about 55,000 people. We talked to 17,000 using existing infrastructures, and out of that came a vision: every student and graduate prepared for a bright and successful future, which certainly is what I wanted for my own children. And one thing that our community said to us, technology needs to be a piece, a very important piece of this. And so I think we've been so once you get your pathway, it's all about how do you achieve it. And, the work's never done, but the way you're going is clear. And I think in a sense, by saying we would like a task force, it's about the technology equipment, but it's really about the vision we have in the state for our children to make sure they have the technological skills to be successful now and beyond high school. So that's kind of what we're really asking for. But I wanted to talk a little bit about what technology's done for us in Springfield. And when we started with one school with a one-to-one initiative, we have 26 schools. And what every other school said, if you're giving these resources to one school, is that fair for the rest of us? And that's a very good question. And what we said is, well, we want to see if this works in the sense of pilot study. But if it does work, then what we know is we have to start advocating on a bigger level to take it beyond the school, to all of the schools in the district. And, I don't only care about Springfield kids, so all the kids beyond there. And so that's kind of where we started. And it evolved from at Springfield Middle School, a school with about 85% poverty, it was the only school in our district to meet AYP 2 years after we implemented the one-to-one initiative. A school with high kids not coming to school, absenteeism. The biggest problem we had is kids were outside getting on the wireless network at night, not wanting to go home, hiding in bushes because they wanted to be on their computers. So then we said, it's okay, you don't need to hide. We want you to be on it. So there was more engagement, kids were coming to school, and we saw great results. And what we also saw through the process is kids don't necessarily need a computer each child, but every child needs access to computers. So we moved more to COWS, computers on wheels, and making sure that technology is important to make sure we close the achievement. achievement gap. And, you know, this is more about studying how to do that. And I just wanted to give you a few examples of how technology is very powerful for the children in Springfield and beyond. First of all, in closing the achievement gap, you know, it's all about are kids on track, and if not, what's an intervention you can bring to children to make sure they do get on track? And there's so many solutions through technology. Read Naturally, a fluency program. You know, you can use, what's the one at the high school where you can retake a course if you didn't pass it the first time. And it's a different modality. It's not going back to the same. You know, we believe the second cycle shouldn't look like the first one. So if a child flunks an English class, if you put them back in the same class with the same teacher, maybe it doesn't work as well as if they use a program online. So the other thing, we have talented and gifted children who excel in two languages and they want to take a third one. Well, we can't afford three languages at our high schools, but we can afford a program that will allow them, because that's their talent, to pursue that electronically. So I think what we're saying is part of the piece of providing a comprehensive education for talented kids to kids who need extra time to be successful, we see technology as a very, very important piece of the puzzle. And we are really passionate about systematically studying. It's kind of like our pathway, the Springfield Quality Ed model. We've achieved incredible things because we have a pathway. So I know I'm passionate enough about this, and Colt is, to say, you know, we'll work on it, and like you, we have very busy jobs, so, you know, but we'll find time, and we're even willing to find some secretarial support out of our districts if that what it take. We know there's not money now. We obviously know your challenge, it's our challenge too, but the truth is we still need to think forward about technology and how to make that a great choice for our children's education.
Thank you.
Thanks. So I'm Colt Gillen, the superintendent at Bethel School District, and I've had the honor over the last 19 years to serve as a teacher and a principal and a school district technology director, and then I'm now superintendent. And in that time, I've focused a lot on instructional technology, and I've written and received about $750,000 worth of technology grants for the districts I've worked for and the students I've worked for. And so I come to it with a little bit of passion, and I share it a little bit about what this task force will be working on. And one of those is this whole notion, there's, I think, an absurdity to the sharing that happens with technology in schools today. And I'll just share a few examples. We don't ask kids to share pencils today. And two centuries ago, when our technology was slates and chalk, we didn't ask kids to share then. We tried to find one for every student. Learning increases when kids have an opportunity to practice the skills that they're working on. Today's coaches have realized that as well. When you used to go into basketball practices, every student on the team would be lined up behind the free throw line, taking a turn with one ball, one at a time, taking the shot. Coaches have learned that if we get more balls in there and we have baskets all the way around the gym, those kids are going to practice more, they're going to get better at their free throw shots, and that's the way it's done today. We're preparing kids for the real world. In the real world, people don't share computers. Even up here, if this team all had to share the same laptop, it wouldn't work. It would be inefficient, and you wouldn't get your work done. So there's power to it. In Oregon, we now have standards for technology that we're required to see that our students meet. We have standards for writing. We don't ask kids to share pencils or grammar books. We have standards for math, and we have find ways to get kids manipulatives, get kids textbooks, calculators, rulers, and full class sets. We have standards in reading, and we not only have a core text for every student, but we have interventions that are specialized to meet individual student needs. But in technology, we have standards, and we still don't have technology in the hands of every student. The equity issue is huge for me. Our two districts, I think, mirror pretty much what you see across the state of Oregon. We have about 55% free and reduced lunch in our school district, and we have a range. So some of our school districts have a very high SES rate, and some of them have a very low. We have one school that has more than 85% free families on free and reduced lunch, and we have one school that has less than 30. The school that has less than 30, our parents are demanding that technology be taught in the school, and they're saying, if you can't provide it, we'll fundraise and we'll buy it. So they've been supplying teachers with computers. They're now working on class sets of computers for students, while these other schools, the parents don't have those means and even that vision. And so the equity issue becomes very real very quickly. I've long time experimented with how do you get more technology in the hands of kids, like I talked about, and I'm one of the founders of the Northwest Handheld Project. This project looked for inexpensive technologies to put in students' hands so that they could learn the technology and learn how to use it to be more efficient. There are computers now that we're attempting to purchase, unfortunately not this year, as you know, but in recent years, that are $300 mini computers, and if you go into Costco, you'll see them. These computers have more technology power in memory, in speed, and in processing power than 90% of the computers in our districts today. And they're only $300 a computer. So this task force can look at problems like that. They can move forward and look at the SES issues, look at equity issues, look at what could be purchased for our schools and how that could be funded in future years. And like Nancy and Al both said, we're not looking for money this year. We're looking to put together a task force that can say what's a reasonable way for Oregon to move forward, because Oregon is behind. We want to clarify the need for technology for students so that they can meet the standards that we've set for them. We want to address the issues of equity, and we want to investigate some cost-effective solutions. And we want to put together a task force that can report back to you with solid ideas in that area. I'm going to say something because I think both of my Springfield colleagues here were a little too humble to mention it. They talked about technology can help you close the achievement gap. This school where they did the technology experiment, the one-to-one experiment, has won one of this state's most prestigious awards. It's the Closing the Achievement Gap Award. And that's a huge piece of the reason that they won. They have put technology in the hands of these kids for the full day, every single day, and the teachers have been trained to use it appropriately, and they're moving all students forward, and they're closing the gap between the students who don't have and the students who do. So
thank you.
I'll stop there.
We have about 7 minutes, so I want to go ahead and call Morgan up quickly, and then we'll do questions quickly, and we also have a bill introduction still to do.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and I'll be very brief. First, I want to thank Representative Beyer. We worked with her and her staff to craft a very narrow task force bill. We took out some of the things sometimes you'll find in task force mileage compensation. We've clearly got a cadre of very dedicated and willing volunteers who are willing to serve on the task force, and we don't need to feed them lunch and have expensive meetings at the Hilton or anything like that. So our folks have worked on the fiscal for this. I know it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I think a few $1,000s. Obviously, the Legislative Fiscal Office has to review the information we're going to submit to them, but the last number I saw was about $7,000 fiscal impact for the department. So I think we can probably do the work of this task force, even if there is not that limited amount of funding to do it. But one thing I would say, just on the topic of task force generally, and I can't think of a good metaphor for task forces, but you can think of ODE as a sponge and task forces as water, and we can absorb a certain amount of task force work, but I've noticed there are quite a few task forces this session. Some of them have funding and some of them don't, and some of them are very limited, and we might be able to do that with an existing resources, and some of them are very complicated and require lots of travel and meeting and outside experts, so I'll tell you if we can't do it. That was my point. So I think we're good to go on this one, so that's all I have to say, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So I'll follow up with you and LFO to see if we can get that statement from LFO about what they're putting on. Are there quick questions for this panel? Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't see any IT people on the task force. Am I missing something?
We've been working with ODE, and when we meet with them, there's IT people there. So I think the intention is that there's a combination of all people who really have knowledge to make this the best it could be.
Chief Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Are we going to have another hearing on this? Because I have a lot of questions.
Yes, I think
that we don't have time for. But one quick one is, why would we need to say, okay, a task force can happen when it sounds like it would be mostly internal anyway. Why do we need this bill?
I think when people talked, it's there's more power if we say, you know, legislators are aware of the need to be a state that really is moving forward, and the State Department and local districts are all working together to make sure our kids have the kind of technology, opportunities to use technology and learn through it that other states do. We see it as a shared sort of effort we would all want to make together.
I'd like to add something that even though the task force doesn't really need any money, that the issue of where technology goes, which becomes online and other issues, that they are so overreaching that this issue really does mean, you know, millions of dollars, you know, more than tens of millions of dollars in terms of overarching strategy. And what we really need to have is have Oregon get its best minds together and give us the best possible strategy. And it's already really started. Like for us, you know, we've been told by the governor to cut expenses, and we put a lot of investment into adopting a math curriculum. Well, then when we had to cut something, and we see that very soon we're going to be losing the basis of textbooks as a primary delivery vehicle, then one of the choices that we're looking at is eliminating the math adoption that we've already done the due diligence on. I think other districts are going to be doing that more and more. So there's really a lot at stake.
So, Representative Thatcher, the only other thing I would say is that then we report directly to you. And that's our intent, is to get a team out there that can find the answers, report them to you, and then you move forward with it the way you see fit.
Representative Comp. Just real quickly, and maybe this, thank you, Chair, isn't part of your discussion, but Sherwood School District has bought whiteboards for every classroom. Are whiteboards part of the discussion that you probably have?
Yeah. Whiteboards would be one of the tools, but that's part of the overall scope.
It's just a component.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. And we, Representative Springer.
Could I ask Representative Comp a question?
Quickly, yes.
When you say whiteboards, are you talking, the only term I know is smart boards?
Oh, smart boards. I'm sorry.
I'm not correcting you. I want to get on the same page.
That was it. Yeah, I'm old school. I was thinking of, but you're right.
Great. Representative Roblin?
Just a comment. It's really nice to see the people that are here. And I want to thank them for the commitment they've made to education. And all of the problems that you have with me asking intelligent questions all come from my instruction under superintendent from the Springfield School District. So she taught me well many, many times over the
years. Want to know what kind of student he was. And this was my student.
Yeah, that's true. And my wife was a student. I mean, this is a person who has given a lot to our state in education. So to Ms. Golden, I say thank you very much. You're a very, very important part in the Oregon education of educators.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. We will have another hearing, and we will arrange for telephonic participation so you don't have to make the long drive up. And thank you again for your patience today. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2380 and open a work session for the introduction of committee bills. And it is LC 2443.
2443, thank you.
Representative Thatcher.
I move that LC 2443 be moved or become a committee bill.
So Representative Thatcher moves that LC 2443. Could I have everybody's attention for a minute while we finish, please? Representative Thatcher has moved that LC 2443 be introduced as a committee bill. And again, this is not a support, an endorsement, an agreement with the bill. It is a method of introducing it into the pipeline systems. Any discussion? Any objection?
Oh, I just think everybody on the panel has signed on to it, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, in some cases, it may be an indicator of support when you look at who is supporting it. Anyway, is there any objection? Seeing none, it is introduced as a bill, and the House Committee on Education is adjourned.